Recently was in Knoxville, Tennessee at the Highlander Center, conspiring with other amazing activists and organizers. And on the way home, the little bitty plane ride home from Knoxville to Atlanta, I ran into a woman named Karen Krogh, who told me a story about in 2008, a lone gunman walked into a Universalist Unitarian Church in Knoxville, Tennessee, her church, and opened fire, killing two, injuring six, and traumatizing hundreds. She wrote a book about it, documented the church's first year of recovery through her pictures. The book is called Love in the Spirit, and here is my interview with Karen Krogh. Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. On July 27th, 2008, a lone gunman walked into the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Knoxville, Tennessee, during a children's production of the musical Annie. He opened fire, killing two people, Linda Krager and Greg McKendry, and injuring six more. My guest today is Karen Krogh. She was and is a member of TVUU and spent a decade birthing a project documenting the church's first year of recovery post the tragic shooting in her book, Love is the Spirit. Karen Krogh has been a photographer for over 30 years. Her work has been featured in the Los Angeles Times, Money, USA, and many other publications. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Kat.
So tell me about the moment when you first learned about the shooting.
It was the Sunday morning, and I received a phone call from my friend Carolyn Rogers, and she informed me that there had just been a shooting at the church, and I only live about 12 minutes from there, so, you know, I quickly got in my car. She said, "Can you come now?" So it was really within that drive over, about halfway through it, that I really, really was just hit so hard with understanding what had just happened. And I can't remember ever feeling that intensity of fear in my life and dread. I knew my father was okay. I had moved to Tennessee to kind of help out my parents. And my father also is a member of that church. And he was not present that day, and neither was I. So I knew he was okay. So I called my brother and sister-in-law in California on the drive over to let them know that they would be hearing about this on the national news within minutes, and that, you know, to let him know that myself and my father was our father was okay. So when I pulled up, I just sort of in the police had already cordoned off all of the parking lots, but, you know, I kind of knew how to get in, and I marched into what was a scene. Of course, this church, the sanctuary, the front doors, all of that was very familiar to me. I'd been attending for years. And just the look on the faces of these people that I had known and loved for years, and the grief, the police, the caution signs. I mean, all these things that now, you know, 11 years after, years prior, you know, these things we hear over and over again from people that have experienced these events, just the horror of it, the horror and the shock of it.
When did you decide to document the recovery process? What was the inspiration for that?
Well, you know, Kat, it was interesting because I was I arrived maybe 20-30 minutes after the actual shooting, and of course they had already apprehended the shooter. How that occurred was that several of the parishioners, led by a 70-year-old retired history professor from UT, they tackled him while he went to reload. I mean, you know, the blessing, if there is any, was that he only had a sawed-off shotgun. He did not have an assault rifle. So when he went to reload, he was tackled and disarmed, therefore limiting the amount of people that actually died or were injured that day. But so I became very active. There was no time to define myself as whatever I was other than just a helper. And other helpers came in that afternoon. But I was available to stay all afternoon and into the evening, and I arrived the next day. And I think it was about the second day, the day after the shooting, That, of course, all the flowers were arriving, the cards, you know, the just the influx of support from all over the nation and the world started happening. And as a photographer, I thought, well, I'm going to document this. I'm going to start recording this experience without, you know, having any plan. You know, I didn't have any intention of creating a project or a book. It was just, this is what I do. Somebody noted to me somewhere down the line that this was part of the way that I healed, and that I was healing myself, was to take photographs.
I didn't know when I met you, and certainly didn't even know when we booked this interview to tell this story on this show, that we would be on the heels of two mass shootings that have happened in the country in the last week, and really three here in Gilroy, California. And there's a lot of conversation of, you know, right now, of course, about the trauma and the dark side of all of this. And I really want to focus on some healing. And so I would love for you to just talk about the church's path and intention around getting to a place of healing, because that's what you document in the book. You don't document, you know, pictures of the gunmen or what, you know, the darkness he brought in there. You document this beautiful healing journey that you all took.
Yes, and thank you for that. And that really is what happened. I mean, I realized after the first year of kind of documenting all these various events that we went through, and how we were coming together as a community, that it was a love story. It really was a love story about people coming together and supporting each other for the purpose of healing, having had this experience that we all shared together. I think that part of what has allowed our community, our particular Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church community, there were some very interesting pieces to it that I think added to our opportunity to heal from such tragedy. Partially because we were a group. Now you think about you're at a Walmart, you're at a movie theater, you're at various sort of public places, and an event like that happens. It's more difficult for people to come together and bond and heal. But because we were a 300 member church, relatively small in the big scheme of things, we could come together, and we met each other. I met so many people after the shooting, and I didn't know who they were. They didn't know who I was. But because of the shared hugs, because of the meals that were brought in, one of the strongest memories I have of that experience was the day of the shooting. Again, I sort of got involved in what can I do to help position. And so I got with the member or the director of the membership committee, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Bone, and we decided we needed to get water and we needed to get pizza or something, you know, food for everybody, because the police officers were asking that nobody leave until everyone could be interviewed. And so while Jerry and I were orchestrating this, you know, run to the pizza joint and the grocery store to get water, the Red Cross arrived. And it was something akin to the fact that the helpers had arrived, you know, people that we didn't know, people that weren't members of our church, you know, that immediate feeling that we had to take care of ourselves. And from that moment that the Red Cross arrived and they brought food and they brought water and they brought smiles and they brought comfort. And so that feeling of a bigger community to kind of help us heal. And that's what I wanted to do with the book. Exactly. I didn't want to talk about the hate. And I can certainly talk about the similarities from 2008 to what happened in Gilroy, what happened at Walmart. We're not quite sure about Dayton yet, about the motivations behind that. But what we have is a group of people that said, no, we're not going to succumb to this. If there's any ever an opportunity for any of the readers or the listeners rather to go back and listen to some of the things that the Reverend Chris Bice said on the rededication service, he talks about how this man had come in to cause chaos and cause death and carnage, but instead what he had done is he had unleashed unbelievable amounts of love, and that we were all going to be resilient and courageous and take care of us. And just for a little background, this person was motivated. It was determined a hate crime. It was in 2008, and he was an unemployed truck driver and decided that liberals were destroying the nation. And he also wrote, he actually physically wrote out an 8-page, what they called a manifesto, that he left in his car that was discovered by police, where he said that he came into that church because he could not get to the liberal leadership of that time, and he wanted to kill as many liberals as possible. So he did come in with the intention of annihilating people based on their political beliefs, and also because this particular church is very welcoming to LGBT people, and that was part of his motivation as well. So, but back to the love part of it is where the leadership of the church immediately said he came in to try to bring about fear and destruction, and instead he unleashed unbelievable love and caring for one another.
How does that happen? How does something like this not shake your faith? Two innocent people, Linda Krieger and Greg McKendry, I feel it's important that we say the names, you know, dead, six injured, but everybody that was in that church, and then people attached to that church, traumatized forever. How does this not shake your faith? How do you walk in love following something like that?
That is such an excellent question, Kat. And, you know, I have to say that as someone who was not really raised in any sort of formal religious background, you know, I wasn't raised a Christian, and really I began my membership in the Unitarian Universalist Church really as much just about community, less about, you know, air quotes, faith, if you will. So I think that there are many people that can speak to perhaps a background in a belief that love overcomes all or forgiveness. I think for our particular community, I think it's a bunch of strong, determined individuals that were not going to allow someone's hatred and someone's, my opinion, ignorance to basically destroy a community. And I think that's what we're seeing. Again, as a sort of informal documentarian, as I see myself, I'm trying to understand this bigger picture. You know, what happened to my unique community, but it's not unique anymore. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of people now that have been impacted either, you know, at their own ground zero or on these, you know, concentric rings that sort of ripple away from, you know, the actual events. So I think that perhaps because we were a faith community, even if, you know, of course, Unitarian Universalists is the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings. I mean, everyone welcome. If be Christian, Jewish, atheist, it doesn't matter. You are welcome. And that's the type of community that I think that isn't so caught up in doctrine that it says that, well, it's going to deal with more of the kind of evil versus good type of thing you may find in other traditional denominations.
So you talked about, you know, it is something now that thousands and thousands of people have experienced. Over the last 10 years, we've seen a rise in mass shootings, right? How frustrating is it for you that this continues to happen? And what do you think the answer is? We have the conversations about gun laws. We have the conversations about mental health. The man in El Paso, Texas, purchased his gun legally.
I think part of what you're asking is, what do I think we can do? Or, you know, almost, yeah, what can we do about this? Well, what if we take it out of just these two kind of categories that everybody tends to go to, mental illness and gun control? So what if we go into really now beginning to look at what it appears to be the root of at least the white supremacist or the hate crime version of it, which is basically the language. You know, I was doing a little research about, you know, the original, you know, you can't cry fire in a crowded theater if there's not a fire. You know, that is not your First Amendment right. And if it's dangerous and false, it is not protected by the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, is that part of what we do? Is that part of what we go after? I don't think that we're anywhere near taking guns away from people. I don't think we should take guns away from people. I don't think it's a black and white, but there are certainly the laws that allow, assault rifles to be sold legally in this nation. Can we do anything about that? Is our, you know, we've really, in the last 2 years, I think that there has been such a light shone upon our political system that there is just no going back. I mean, we really see the corruption now. We really see what motivates so many of our politicians. And will we be able to do anything about that? Is that where the buck ends? Is that our only option? I mean, you know, I think they're now talking about metal detectors at public stores, at Walmarts, at whatever. Is that going to stop it? You know, I don't know.
Karen Krogh, where can people find your book, Love is the Spirit?
It is available at blurb.com, B-L-U-R-B, which is a self-publishing company. And if you just go to blurb.com into their bookstore and type in Love is the Spirit, you will have a link to either a hard copy or a soft copy of the book.
You have been listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. I have been in conversation with Karen Krogh, a photographer for over 30 years with work featured in the Los Angeles Times, Money USA, and many other publications. Her book is Love is the Spirit, documenting the first year of healing post the July 27th, 2008 shooting at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church in Knoxville, Tennessee. Karen, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Kat. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.